Why not? It was fine 3 seconds ago. Has your dad been round again?
No. I just have a lot of things that I have to do, and Pickwick needs kennelling, and I have to pick him up at the station as airships make him nervous. You remember the time we took him up to Mull and he vomited all over the steward? I checked myself. I was starting to blabber like an idiot.
And don't tell me, added Landon. You have to wash your hair.
Very funny.
What work are you doing in Swindon anyway? Asked Landon.
I wash up at Smiley Burger.
Sure you do. Spec ops?
I nodded my head. I joined Swindon's Literatech unit.
Permanently? He asked. I mean, you've come back to Swindon for good?
I don't know.
I placed my hand on his. I wanted to hug him and burst into tears and tell him I loved him and would always love him, like some huge emotional dumb girlie. But time wasn't quite right, as my father would say. I decided to get on the question offensive instead, so I asked, Are you married?
No.
Never thought about it?
I thought about it a lot.
We both lapsed into silence. There was so much to say that neither of us could think of any way to start. Landon opened a second front. Want to see Richard III?
Is it still running?
Of course.
I'm tempted, but the fact remains I don't know when I will be free. Things are volatile at present.
I could see he didn't believe me. I couldn't really tell him I was on the trail of a master criminal who could steal thoughts and project images at will, who was invisible on film and could murder and laugh as he did so.
Landon sighed, dug out a calling card, and placed it on the counter.
Call me, whenever you're free. Promise?
Promise.
He kissed me on the cheek, finished his drink, looked at me again, and limped out of the bar. I was left looking at his calling card. I didn't pick it up. I didn't need to. The number was the one I remembered. My room was exactly like all the other rooms in the hotel. The pictures were screwed to the walls, and the drinks in the minibar had been opened, drunk, then resealed with water or cold tea by travelling reps too mean to pay for them. The room faced north. I could just see the airship field. A large 40-seater was moored on the mast, its silver flanks floodlit in the dark night. The small dirigible that had brought me in had continued on to Salisbury. I briefly thought about catching it again when it called on its return the day after tomorrow. I turned on the television just in time to catch Today in Parliament. The Crimean debate had been raging all day and wasn't over yet. I emptied my pockets of loose change, took my automatic out of its shoulder holster and opened the bedside drawer. It was full. Apart from the Gideon's Bible, there were the teachings of Buddha and an English copy of the Quran. There was also a GSD volume of prayer and a Wesleyan pamphlet, two amulets from the Society for Christian Awareness, the Thoughts of St. Zvilks, and now the mandatory complete works of William Shakespeare. I removed all the books, stuffed them in the cupboard, and placed my automatic in the drawer instead. I unzipped my case and started to organise my room. I hadn't rented out my apartment in London. I didn't know if I was staying here or not. Oddly, the town had started to feel very comfortable, and I wasn't sure whether I liked that or not. I laid everything on my bed and then put it carefully away. I placed a few books on the desk and the life-saving copy of Jane Eyre onto the bedside table. I picked up Landon's photo and walked over to the bureau, thought for a moment, and then placed it upside down in my knicker drawer. With the real thing around, I had no need for an image. The TV droned on. Despite intervention by the French and a Russian guarantee of safe habitation for English settlers, it looks as though the English government will not be resuming its place around the table at Budapest. With England still adamant about an offensive using the new so-called Stonk plasma rifle, peace will not be descending on the Black Sea Peninsula. The anchorman shuffled some papers. Home news now, and violence flared again in Chichester as a group of neo-surrealists gathered to celebrate the 4th anniversary of the legalisation of surrealism. On the spot for Toad News Network is Henry Grubb. Henry, how are things down there?
A shaky live picture came onto the screen, and I stopped for a moment to watch. Behind Grubb was a car that had been overturned and set on fire, and several officers were in riot gear. Henry Grubb, who was in training for the job of Crimean correspondent and secretly hoped that the war wouldn't end until he had had a chance to get out there, wore a navy blue flak jacket and spoke with the urgent, halting speech of a correspondent in a war zone. "Things are a bit hot down here, Brian. I'm 100 yards from the riot zone and I can see several cars overturned and on fire. The police have been trying to keep the factions apart all day, but the sheer weight of numbers has been against them. This evening, several hundred Raphaelites surrounded the Ne Pas Une Pipe public house, where 100 neo-surrealists have barricaded themselves in. The demonstrators outside chanted Italian Renaissance slogans, and then stones and missiles were thrown. The neo-surrealists responded by charging the lines protected by large soft watches and seemed to be winning until the police moved in. Wait, I can just see a man arrested by the police. I'll try and get an interview. I shook my head sadly and put some shoes in the bottom of the wardrobe. There was violence when surrealism was banned, and there was violence as the same ban was lifted. Grubb continued his broadcast as he intercepted a policeman marching away a youth dressed in 16th century garb with a faithful reproduction of the Hand of God from the Sistine Chapel tattooed on his face. "Excuse me, sir, how would you counter the criticism that you are an intolerant bunch with little respect for the value of change and experimentation in all aspects of art?" The Renaissanceite glanced at the camera with an angry scowl. "People say we're just Renaissanceites causing trouble, but I've seen Baroque kids, Raphaelites, Romantics and Mannerists here tonight. It's a massive show of classical artistic unity against these frivolous bastards who cower beneath the safety of the word progress. It's not just..." The police officer intervened and dragged him away. Grubb ducked a flying brick and then wound up his report. "This is Henry Grubb, reporting for Toad News Network, live from Chichester." I turned off the television with a remote that was chained to the bedside table. I sat on the bed and pulled out my hair tie, let my hair down, and rubbed my scalp. I sniffed dubiously at my hair and decided against a shower. I had been harder than I intended with Landon. Even with our differences, we still had more than enough in common to be good friends.
Chapter 11. Polly Flashes Upon the Inward Eye. I think Wordsworth was as surprised to see me as I was him. It can't be usual to go to your favourite memory only to find someone already there, admiring the view ahead of you. Polly next, interviewed exclusively for The Owl on Sunday. As I was dealing with Landon in my own clumsy way, my uncle and aunt were hard at work in Mycroft's workshop. As I was to learn later, things seemed to be going quite well. To begin with, at any rate. Mycroft was feeding his bookworms in the workshop when Polly entered. She had just completed some mathematical calculations of almost incomprehensible complexity for him. "I have the answer you wanted, Crofty, my love," she said, sucking the end of a well-worn pencil. "And that is?" asked Mycroft, busily pouring prepositions onto the bookworms, who devoured the abstract food greedily. "9. Mycroft mumbled something and jotted the figure down on a pad. He opened the large brass-reinforced book that I had not quite been introduced to the night before to reveal a cavity into which he placed a large print copy of Wordsworth's poem I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. To this he added the bookworms, who busily got to work. They slithered over the text, their small bodies and unfathomable collective id unconsciously examining every sentence, word, vowel, sound and syllable. They probed deeply into the historical, biographical and geographical allusions. Then they explored the inner meanings hidden within the meter and rhythm and juggled ingeniously with subtext, content and inflection. After that, they made up a few verses of their own and converted the result into binary. Lakes, daffodils, solitude, memory, whispered the worms excitedly as Mycroft carefully closed the book and locked it. He connected up the heavy mains feed to the back of the book and switched the power switch to on. He then started work on the myriad of knobs and dials that covered the front of the heavy volume. Despite the prose portal being essentially a biomechanism, there were still many delicate procedures that had to be set before the device would work. And since the portal was of an absurd complexity, Mycroft was forced to write up the precise sequence of start-up events and combinations in a small child's exercise book, of which, ever wary of foreign spies, he held the only copy. He studied the small book for several moments before twisting dials, setting switches, and gently increasing the power, all the while muttering to himself and Polly, "Binometrics, spherics, numerics, I'm... on?" "Off," replied Mycroft sadly. "No, wait. There." He smiled happily as the last of the warning lights extinguished. He took his wife's hand and squeezed it affectionately. "Would you care to have the honour?" he asked. "First human being to step inside a Wordsworth poem?" Polly looked at him uneasily.
"Are you sure it's safe?"
"As safe as the houses," he assured her. "I went into the wreck of the Hesperus an hour ago."
"Really? What was it like?"
"Wet, and I think I left my jacket behind."
"The one I gave you for Christmas?"
"No, the other one, the blue one with large checks."
"That's the one I did give you for Christmas," she scolded.
"I wish you would be more careful.
What was it you wanted me to do?"
Just stand here. If all goes well, as soon as I press this large green button, the worms will open a door to the daffodils that William Wordsworth knew and loved."
"And if all doesn't go well?" asked Polly, slightly nervously. Owen's demise inside a giant meringue never failed to impinge on her thoughts whenever she guinea-pigged one of her husband's machines, but apart from some slight singeing while testing a one-man butane-powered pantomime horse, none of Mycroft's devices had ever harmed her at all.
"Hmm," said Mycroft thoughtfully. "It is possible, although highly unlikely, that I could start a chain reaction that will fuse matter and annihilate the known universe."
"Really?"
"No, not really at all. My little joke. Are you ready?"
Polly smiled.
"Ready."
Mycroft pressed the large green button, and there was a low hum from the book. The streetlights flickered and dimmed outside as the machine drew a huge quantity of power to convert the bookworm's binometric information. As they both watched, a thin shaft of light appeared in the workshop, as though a door had been opened from a winter's day into summer. Dust glistened in the beam of light, which gradually grew broader until it was large enough to enter.
"All you have to do is step through," yelled Mycroft above the noise of the machine. "To open the door requires a lot of power. You have to hurry."
The high voltage was making the air heavy. Metallic objects close by were starting to dance and crackle with static. Polly stepped closer to the door and smiled nervously at her husband. The shimmering expanse of white light rippled as she put her hand up to touch it. She took a deep breath and stepped through the portal. There was a bright flash and a burst of heavy electrical discharge. Two small balls of highly charged gas plasma formed spontaneously near the machine and barreled out in two directions. Mycroft had to duck as one sailed past him and burst harmlessly on the Rolls-Royce. The other exploded on the olfactograph and started a small fire. Just as quickly, the light and sound died away, the doorway closed, and the streetlights outside flickered up to full brightness again.
"Clouds, jocund company, sprightly dance," chattered the worms contentedly as the needles flicked and rocked on the cover of the book, the 2-minute countdown to the reopening of the portal already in progress. Mycroft smiled happily and patted his pockets for his pipe until he realized with dismay that it too was inside Hesperus. So instead, he sat down on the prototype of a sarcasm early warning device and waited. Everything so far was working extremely well. On the other side of the prose portal, Polly stood on the grassy bank of a large lake where the water gently lapped against the shore. The sun was shining brightly,
and small puffy clouds floated lazily across the azure sky.